Hello, in this audio snippet, we will try to continue talking about Charles Sumner and Ulysses Grant in the context of America post the Civil War period. And this is all related to Black America in a more general sense. But before we go into that, we'd like to say several things related to things going on recently. And as we always share, even though some of these initial things we talk about in these recordings seem unrelated to the main topic, they are, in a way, all intertwined. So I'd like to talk about something that I would call the current silence, very troubling silence that's going on. And it's related to what I also call the three war fronts that we have currently in the world, where people are beginning to fight for freedom. And one of those is Brazil. As some of you may know, at the time of this recording, Brazil just had an election, and Jair Bolsonaro, who is considered the Brazilian Trump, went up against a guy named Lula, Lula da Silva, or some stupid name like that. And he was a former president of Brazil, a communist. He threw Brazil down the toilet while he was president. And he was eventually imprisoned because of some corruption that he was engaging in. Before the elections, a judge that was a leftist and who leaned towards Lula threw out the charges. Something happened, and this judge then used that opportunity. I'm not too well aware of the details, but the thing is that the judge used some sort of opportunity to kind of throw out the charges against Lula, and he was immediately set free. And, you know, just in time to be able to run for the election. And there was a lot of fraud going that happened in Brazil, and I'm pretty sure that the Democrat Party here in America gave a lot of counseling or technical advice on how to carry out the fraud, and the election was stolen from Bolsonaro, and Lula supposedly won, even though Bolsonaro, just like what happened in America, Bolsonaro was ahead for quite a while, and then suddenly, towards the end of the counting, suddenly, out of nowhere, Lula took the lead and won. So it's not the again that reflects fraud and many other things that went on. Apparently, there validate the fraud, the fact that there was a fraud, but just that alone, that thing where one candidate is winning, there's a pattern of voting, and then suddenly there is this drastic change, just like what happened in America in 2020, and again in just a few weeks ago here in the recent midterm elections. So the people of Brazil were outraged because I wouldn't say that Bolsonaro is like supported by 80% of the Brazilian population, but he is supported by a majority of it, maybe 55, I would dare say, if not more, percent of the population. And they knew that they had been cheated. And they went out in massive protests. And the sad thing is that I don't hear the regular media, especially in America, really talk much about the protests. But there was a protest in I think it might have been in Rio or Sao Paulo, one of those cities, where it was estimated that the 3 million Brazilians gathered to protest the election official election results, and even like for example in the World Cup, some people took videos of Brazilian fans who are in Qatar. There should be no one in Qatar watching these games. Everyone should have boycotted attending that World Cup. But there were some Brazilians there, and some of them started shouting in Portuguese in the middle of a football game, shouting that Lula was a thief and that he deserved to go to prison. And they were shouting that during a football match. And that just goes to show you the level of frustration of the people of Brazil. And they have been protesting, not just that 3 million crowd that protested that one day. They have continued to protest. And in some places, they've been stopping traffic with all the massive amount of people who have been going out and decrying the results of the election. So they are really outraged. And the military of Brazil seems to agree with the people of Brazil, and they know that something went awry, and they have apparently the military of Brazil have said to Bolsonaro, hey, you tell us and we will take out Lula. But apparently and that gives me a little bit of concern that Bolsonaro might be going the on the high road. I hope he's not doing that. I really hope he's not doing that, that he's not trying to go on the high road and say, no, I'm not going to ask the military to do it. It has to be through legal means. And there is no legality anymore. I hope Bolsonaro understands that, just like the Republicans in America need to understand that there's no legality anymore. The system is broken. If he lets Lula do his thing, he's going to destroy Brazil and do great persecution of the supporters of Bolsonaro, because he, for example, immediately sent out an executive order or something to that effect, or a request asking for the assets and bank account of protesters to be frozen. And also, apparently, he issued an order or something saying that the Brazilian government had the right to take away the kids of protesters, of election protesters, that the government could come and take them because the parents were unfit to be parents because they dared to question the election results. So that's what the kind of savage bastard we're talking about. And if Bolsonaro tries to take the quote high road, which wouldn't be the high road, it'd be the low road actually. But if he tries to take the high road and not accept the military's offer, then that's going to lead to a great persecution, and he's going to be doing pulling a Trump on the Brazilian people, just like Trump constantly betrayed the people who supported him. I hope Bolsonaro doesn't do the same thing and betray the people of Brazil by not working with the military to have this situation changed. And if he wants to, quote, take the high road, then let him do something like, okay, this election was clearly illegal. We will clean the slate and do a new election, and we'll make sure that this new election is fair and square, and instead of just doing an outright military coup. But the thing is that the people of Brazil are protesting. There is outrage, and it's kind of sad that the Brazilians are protesting, but the Americans are not. And I've always believed there's a certain weird parallel or peculiar parallel between America and Brazil. Brazil is, in a certain sense, the South American America, the South American United States. They even have a federal system like we do, or similar in a sense. They are a federal government. They have a melting pot of people from different races. Brazil is very different from the rest of what is called Latin America. They are the only Portuguese-speaking country in Latin America. All the others are Hispanic. The rest is Hispanic America, you could say. They have people from Germany, people from Italy, people from Portugal, of course. Amerindians also there. It's a mix, and black people, a strong black population, because of they had plantations just like in America. They had slavery just like in America, and their slavery lasted even longer than America's. I think theirs ended in, I could be wrong on this, but I think it ended in the 1880s or something. So it ended a few years after it officially, quote, ended in America. And so there's a lot of parallels, but it seems like Brazil is kind of taking beginning to take a higher road as America's going down an incline, you could say. In other words, Brazil is going uphill while America is going downhill. And they have had the bravery to protest. And a lot of people have pointed out that in those protests, it's kind of curious that there are no counter protests of the Lula supporters, just like what happens happened here in America, that wherever the son of a bitch, little bastard, senile bastard, who shuffles his feet in the White House, whenever he, has a diaper change and goes out to speak, people don't come out in droves to meet him. He doesn't draw masses, unlike Trump, who draws masses everywhere. The senile bastard does not, and that's always kind of a strange thing. How can a person who got the most votes in the history of this country, literally, I'm not exaggerating, he got more votes than anybody else in the history of this country, how can such a person not have any popularity? And that's obviously another confirmation that he did steal the election. And the same thing kind of happens in Brazil. Like right now, if Lula really won, why aren't, and Bolsonaro's people are, causing all this mayhem, why aren't the Lula supporters, who are also very radical, they are very leftist. Lula is a communist. He is a socialist, just on the door of communism. But in his heart, he is a communist. And so these radical supporters who are very left-wing, very fanatical, why aren't they out there? So many people voted for him, why aren't there counter-protests of people supporting Lula and say, hey, we denounce all this talk about election fraud, and that's not true. It's the Bolsonaro people trying to take it away from us. Why aren't the millions of Lula supporters who supposedly voted for him out on the streets to counterbalance, you could say, the Bolsonaro protests? There are nobody's protesting for Lula. Nobody in Brazil. It's just the Bolsonaro people in millions, literally. Imagine 3 million, and it is believed that that gathering of 3 million people might be the greatest, the largest gathering of people protesting peacefully for something in the history of the world. I mean, that's how radical the protest is, and unfortunately, no one is listening. It's other than the people of Brazil who have been protesting. It seems like the rest of the world couldn't care less. And yes, conservatives in America have been pointing that out, as if to say, "Hey, look at that. It's kind of what happened to us." But other than that, I don't feel that I could be wrong with this, and I don't think I am. That conservatives in America are really not that. They couldn't care less what happens in Brazil. Only it only interests them in the context of validating what their claims about election fraud here in America. That's probably the only thing. They don't have any love for the people of Brazil. They have no interest for freedom there. A few of them might, but it's always very limited. It's always very self-serving. Conservatism is it's a very selfish philosophy. Everything revolves around the self. What benefits us? It's also, you know, very quote patriotic. We spoke about that before. How destructive that philosophy is. The philosophy of patriotism, and so everything is benefits America, and the rest of the world can go to hell. We couldn't care less about them. It's America first. America first. And that attitude is at the end destructive. It actually does more harm to America. The America First attitude is actually anti-American. It destroys America in the long term, because you reap what you sow. Conservatives are very short term. Just to put it in certain terminology, we've spoken about the five different types of human personalities. The visionary, the second one, I always list them in the same order. It's judge, visionary, conqueror, server, and organizer. The second one, the visionary personality, is very future-oriented. And as such, it's always sowing to reap, to harvest, to reap a harvest in the future, but it's like a sacrifice now. You don't see it. It's like you're making a sacrifice. You don't see the results right away, but you know that in the long term, you will see a harvest from what you sowed into the ground. Because when you sow something into the ground, it disappears. If you have a seed, you have it in your hand, you have it, you can touch it, you can feel it. But once you put it into the ground and bury it, it's gone. It's like, to your eyes, it's not there. It's like you wasted the seed. But the seed is there doing its work, and eventually it will reap a harvest. And the visionary personality understands that. And that's why visionaries are sacrificial. They are willing to give of themselves and sacrifice, even sometimes literal, you know, sacrifice of their lives for the sake of a higher cause. So the visionaries tend to become martyrs rather frequently because of that. The fifth personality is all five personalities are not inherently good or evil. Actually, they are initially good, all of them, but they can get distorted. So even though they're all good by default, you could say, number two and number five, the organizer and the visionary, tend to conflict a bit. It's like they are different sides of the same coin. They're like an odd couple. If you put them together, they are different in the way they operate. But they, if they're working correctly, they will complement each other instead of fight each other. But when there's something awry in one of the two, then they start becoming enemies. And the organizer is different from the visionary in the sense that it focuses more on the short term, and it focuses on the past. The visionary focuses on the future. That's why it doesn't worry so much about sacrificing in the present, because it's thinking about the future. The organizer has to keep looking back. It's part of the personality. You have to be looking backwards to organize things. You have to. That's why people who are organizers are usually historians, archaeologists. You know, the archaeologists have to look back in history, dig up stuff, and so they do the opposite of the visionary. The visionary buries things in the ground as a seed, and the archaeologist, who is an organizer, comes and digs things up from the past. And then he catalogs it, the organizer has to keep looking back. It's just part of the personality, and so that's why that's the beginning of the clash between the organizer and the visionary. The visionary is thinking ahead, the organizer is looking back, and the organizer, when he gets kind of caught up in when he doesn't allow the truth to shape his personality, when it degrades, then the organizer becomes a person who lives in the past, who gets caught up in traditions, who believes something is right because it's the tradition of our fathers and our forefathers, and that's what makes it right. And conservatives are like that. They keep saying, "Oh, our American values, the traditions of our founding fathers," and they get this gooey feeling from that. That's what organizers do. They keep looking to the past, and they find validation of things because it has been passed down through the generations. That's what makes it true to them. And the visionary is like shedding things from the past and looking towards the future, and seeing new things that the organizer, when he is he gets distracted, no longer is able to see. And the organizer also has this tendency to become very, very selfish, because he focuses on the past. He focuses on what is visible, tangible. The visionary sees invisible things. The visionary looks out into the future and sees these great things that the organizer cannot see, because the organizer is looking towards the past and focusing on the visible to organize it, to set it, to create methods and procedures to organize things. The visionary is constantly looking forward towards these crazy unseen things. So the organizer, who's always focused on the past, focused on the visible, tends to become very selfish and a hoarder of things, because he doesn't want to let things go. He doesn't understand the concept when he's not coordinated with the truth, shall we say. He is very reluctant to sow something into the ground, because the moment he stops seeing it, he considers it lost. And therefore, he never gives to so that down the road he will receive back. That makes him very selfish, and everything starts revolving around him and whatever benefits him in the short term. And he kind of becomes like the person who starts, getting old and just gathering money and money and money. And then he dies with all this wealth, and he never really used it or gave it to others or blessed others with it. He just, because he's just living for the present. And the organizer, when he gets corrupted, is the person who is most afraid of death. The visionary is the one who couldn't care less. If I have to die, I will die, you know, that sort of thing. The organizer is always kind of holding on for dear life, literally, especially because, you know, once they're dead, to them, there is no future. There's nothing after death. So what's the point of thinking about anything beyond death? So they become very selfish, and that's what conservatives do all the time. And that's why they always think America first and this and that. Like, why would we have to go fight for the people of Iraq? How does that benefit us? They didn't attack us. So all these warmongers who are promoting war with other countries and this and that, and that's how they begin to interpret it. But they don't realize that our war in Iraq prevented at least two more 9/11 type attacks. I don't know why I'm saying this. I just know this. I know for a fact that one of the attacks that was going to happen would have been the attack on the U.S. bank building in Los Angeles. That's the 101-story, I think, building in downtown Los Angeles, the tallest building west of the Mississippi, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know why I'm saying this, but I know in my knower that building would have been hit as well. But something happened when we fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. But in both wars, we began to digress the efforts of the terrorists towards the Middle East. It's like we forced them to pay attention to us in the Middle East, and they stopped making efforts to try to attack America, the American territory again. We kept them busy, shall we say. And we could have overthrown the whole system of tyrants if Bush had done what needed to be done, as we've tried to explain before. If he had gone full throttle from the beginning, we could have ended Assad's regime in Syria very quickly. He would have run away like a scared little rat out of Syria, and democracy would have started in Syria. We would have also emboldened the Iranian people to fight against the regime in Iran, and Iran's dictatorship would have been toppled, and then would have had an outbreak of democracy and freedom in the Middle East, and that would have guaranteed a longer term freedom, you could say, or ending of freedom from terrorism, or the ending of terrorism, because once people begin to experience freedom, then the message of terrorism doesn't sound as exciting or as appealing. And but see, the conservative doesn't think long term like that, and the conservative doesn't understand that America has been given blessings as a responsibility to then do something in the world, to be a light to the world, a light of freedom, a light of a force of freedom in the world. And we have been given all these blessings because of that responsibility. And if we shirk the responsibility, we say, hey, we don't care about that, then those blessings become will be taken away, because there's no more reason for us to be the most powerful nation on earth if we're not going to be an influence for good in the world, if we're not willing to pay a price to bless others. Therefore, that's why what's happening in Brazil is only seen from a very limited perspective by conservatives. And other than a few comments about that, it seems like no one else cares. No one cares. And so the Brazilian people are on their own. The other war front is the war front in China. The people in China are waking up. And it's interesting because a few weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was thinking to myself, I'm sick and tired of China being so passive, the Chinese people being so passive. I'm of Chinese descent. I don't see myself as Chinese. I know I'm of Chinese descent, but that does not, I don't derive my identity from that. As I've shared before, our identity should be derived from our own. We build our own character. We are the architects of our own destiny. I don't define my identity or my value as a human being based on the actions of other people of the same race or ethnicity. That's stupid. But the thing is, I was thinking as an independent person, not just because of any Chinese DNA or whatever. I was saying to myself, why the hell are the Chinese so passive? There are 1.3 billion people. I understand they've been under this oppression since 1949. It's, 73 years of oppression at the time of this recording. And it just takes a toll, just like with the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people were under this oppression under Hussein. And once you get trapped in the system, you become a sheep almost by default. You're born a sheep in a sense. And you don't respond, you don't attack. But I have felt that with the Chinese, there is a bit of the organizer thing, again, in them. The Chinese have a combination of different personalities. They are very judge. They have a strong judge personality. But they also have a lot of organizer in them. And the organizer part of them causes them a lot, in many ways, to kind of live for the short term and become very cautious. Organizers, when they go astray, they become very cautious people because they're so afraid of death that they never take risks and so forth, because they don't want to die. And it's as if they, even though they've grown up like sheep, it seems like they kind of become comfortable being sheep. It's like they like it. And also you have to take into account that the Chinese regime is very oppressive. So if you say anything, if you question anything, then you are immediately attacked. So I was saying to myself, they have to wake up. They have to wake up. And I was saying it within me with great outrage. You have to wake up. And then a few days later, I started hearing about these stories of the Chinese people beginning to protest on the streets in different cities of China. And I think it all started because of some incidents, because they are practicing, again, the zero COVID, whatever policy of locking everybody down. So they want to make the virus disappear off the face of the earth, which is not the strategy to deal with this thing, but that's another story. The thing is that they are still practicing that, and whenever someone tests positive, it's like they lock down the whole city and so forth. It's just stupidity. But it's part of that power, trip that the bastards in the northern capital are pursuing. You know, they know that they have the authority to do it, the power to do it. They just go ahead and do it as a way to just stick it to the people and show them who's boss. And because of those ridiculous lockdowns, people have been dying. Because they just can't go out. Like, there was this building that had a fire in some city, I forget which one, and people died because they couldn't get out of the building because they were locked inside the building because of the lockdown policies, and the people burned to death, and that created outrage and along with other things, and people have just said enough is enough, and they're beginning to protest, and they're going out and they're going like defiant, like saying, because I in my head it's like it's 1.3 billion people. Okay, imagine if half of the population decides enough is enough. I mean, you can have all the tanks in the world, all the armies in the world, all the soldiers in the world, and it's just not going to be enough. No government can suppress 1.3 billion people if the 1.3 billion people say enough is enough. And they have even gone to the point of doing this thing where they protest with a white piece of paper. So they don't write anything because they know that if they write it, they will get you know, arrested or whatever, or censored. So they go out on the streets and they hold up a white piece of paper, and people have been taking pictures of that and posting it online and so forth. And the Chinese officials have been trying. I was hearing that they have been having trouble keeping up with the censoring of all these pictures with people holding up a blank sheet of paper. Imagine how ridiculous that is. But the point is that so many people are doing it that the censors, who are keeping track of, imagine what a horrible society to live in. There are censors keeping track of all the pictures being posted online, and you know, to persecute people and put them in prison if they say anything that is contrary to the regime. So even blank pieces of paper, which is kind of like a veiled way of saying, hey, you know, it's like I'm not saying anything bad, but by holding up this piece of paper, I'm symbolically saying, hey, I am being censored, not given the freedom to even say one word or put one word in this piece of paper. That's kind of the message. And they've been trying to censor those, the government people, and they haven't been able to keep up because so many people are doing it. And that's how you overrun, that's how you drive out all these people. You just overwhelm them. And that fight is going on in China. And again, the mainstream media here in America, completely silent about it, completely silent. And the conservatives, again, every now and then point it out, just as a way of just validating their own beliefs. But they really have no interest in fighting for China in any way, shape, or form. Maybe a few of them do, but there's no love. Visionaries are, maybe it's the personality most connected to love, in a sense. They should all be connected, but the one that's kind of most, like, I don't know if the word is dynamically connected to love, is the visionary personality. Because love is sacrificial. Love is, you know, you sacrifice yourself for someone else. And these conservatives don't have that. When you read their articles, they just don't have it. When you read the comments, you see it. They don't have love, unless the love is of something that will make America first again, make America great again, you know, MAGA, whatever. So they don't see what's going on in China. They don't bleed in their hearts for China. They just couldn't care less, to be frank. And the leftists obviously don't care about the people of China because to them, China is the model of how to run the perfect tyranny, the perfect government that controls the people, the lives of people. And that's why all the leftists are always so laudatory of what goes on in China, always praising them for how they handled the virus and this and that and the other, instead of siding with the people. So the Chinese people are on their own as well, just like the Brazilians. And then we have the third war front, which is the people of Iran, who are, you know, protesting. And it all started because of this woman who apparently was killed because she wasn't wearing the thing over her head all the way down, or I don't know. It was like she was showing a little bit too much hair. I forget the detail. It's just some ridiculous thing, and the police killed her because of that, and that created the outrage. And again, conservatives pointed out every now and then, just to criticize Bite Me, because that's a way of embarrassing Bite Me, as if to say, hey, Bite Me, don't you care about this? You care about the Ukrainians, but you don't care about this. So they do it more as a way to show up the Democrats instead of really caring about the people of Iran. And to all of them, it's like, okay, let them take care of it themselves. It's not our problem. And I've read some comments in some websites when they, you know, write comments about a story related to this, what's going on in Iran. They always say, oh, that they chose their own regime. Remember what they did in 79 with the U.S. embassy and this and that and the other. So they have it coming to them. Let them fix it themselves. You know, that sort of very stupid, selfish attitude, not being aware that what happened in 79 was done by a strong minority, but it was not, it was still a minority, and the people of Iran are really not that into what, you know, these radicals have been doing, and especially the youth who has grown up, even though they've grown up under this horrible regime, they still have a yearning for freedom. They are Western friendly, and they don't want any of that. But the conservative doesn't think, you know, doesn't care. It's like, to him, Iran is just something I can use politically, but there is no fighting for them. I don't think I've heard Trump really say too much in favor of Iran. So the Iranian people are, again, on their own. Three groups of people: the Brazilians, the Chinese, and the Iranians. And they're all on their own, and they're fighting for freedom, to be set free from oppression, and no one seems to care. And it's sad that you know, people like Trump or others who have the megaphone, who have the tannoys to go out and say what needs to be said and be heard by millions of people, don't say anything. I can only imagine, you know, someone like JFK, if he was around. He would be, or Ronald Reagan would be galvanizing the people with, you know, these powerful speeches to get people to pay attention to what's going on and speak poetically and forcefully about these things, to stir people, to support these oppressed people. But there's nothing like that. And just as a side note, I know JFK had a lot of flaws, especially in his personal life. But I know if you listen to him in his speeches and you forget that he's a Democrat, you actually forget that he's a Democrat. He sounds more like a Republican of, you know, if you just take the tape and imagine that it's someone speaking in the modern times or 10 years ago, you would say, oh, that guy sounds like a Republican, like a conservative, or not a conservative, but you know what I mean. A person, he doesn't sound like a liberal nut job, like a Democrat, even though he was from the Democrat Party. But the thing is, and he had a touch of the visionary personality. That's why he was the one who boldly said, we will be on the moon before the end of the decade. And lo and behold, we were on the moon before the end of the decade. And remember Ronald Reagan, when he stood in front of the wall, by the Berlin Wall, and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And the people erupted. And that was like this. It sent this sound wave across the earth. And people knew the time had come and the wall has to come tumbling down. And it came tumbling down. There are no people like that out in the public. We're speaking with authority. We're speaking with poetic power to stir people and galvanize them in support of freedom around the world, in Brazil, in China, in Iran, here in America. And it's that. And you know why that is? Because of that organizer thing. It's the selfishness, just inherent selfishness. And that's why the country, America, is dying. That's why Europe seems to be slowly dying. It's the same thing. And Ronald Reagan had a touch of the visionary, too. You listen to his speeches and you hear a man who has a vision, who has a hope of something. He's working towards something. And that's why he could stir people with his speeches. You know, that's why he was called the great communicator. The thing is that there are no people like that around. Trump is very self-serving. The other ones who are very self-serving are the conquerors when they go astray. The personality number three, shall we say, because they are, and you have to be a little bit self-confident to be a conqueror. You have to be narcissistic, quote unquote, in a sense, and you have to go out and fight. You have to believe in yourself. You have to believe and have others come to believe in you. You know, just like Alexander the Great. He had his army believing in him, that he could take them to the ends of the earth and conquer every single place they went to. And he almost literally did take them to the ends of the earth, you know, at least of the known earth at that time to the Greeks. You have to have that thing where you believe in yourself and you get other people to believe in you, to trust you. There's something about you and I'm going to follow you. And Trump has that, but the problem is when they go astray, then it becomes a self-serving thing. Everything is about them, and Trump is like that. That's why he doesn't have enough within him to stir people towards freedom. As an example, recently he released a video, which is kind of like a little praiseworthy, quote unquote. On the January 6th prisoners, you know, the people who protested in the Capitol on January 6th of 2021 and who are still in jail and are being mistreated and treated like dirt, and so many rights are being violated, and again, the silence. You know, as I've said multiple times in these audio snippets, if I were Trump, I would be parked outside of Capitol Hill every day. You know, I'd have the money to go get myself a nice trailer and park myself there and live there and step out every day from the trailer and stand in front of the Capitol steps with a picket sign and protesting constantly and demanding to talk to Pelosi or to the bastard Schumer or whoever, or to the leadership of the Congress, the Congress leadership, to get them to end the unfair treatment and release the January 6th prisoners, and to and also to expose all that happened that day, how the Capitol Police opened the doors for the protesters. It was entrapment to get them inside so that they could then make a big deal out of it and use it as a way to show the protesting people a lesson, like we're going to do this to you if you dare to question our theft. And I would be doing that, and I would be going to try to go visit them in the prison and going in. And if they tell me, hey, you can't go in, I'd say, I demand to go in. And I would cause a ruckus as Trump, as the quote former president, and I would get myself arrested and say, okay, I'm not leaving. And if you don't let me in to talk to them, then arrest me and put me in there with them. See, that's what a visionary would do. That's what a person who says, I don't care about the future. But Trump is not would never do something like that, because to him, he does more good by staying, you know, kind of a little bit away from all of those things. Because, if I win and become president again, then I can pardon them. And I have more ways to help them than by doing these crazy things. So he would never do that. And so he's thinking about his candidate. And also he's saying, if I get arrested and this happens to me, then I won't be eligible to be a candidate in 2024. So he's thinking about his political future and all of this. But I would say to him, hey, you're going to die anyway. You're never going to be in the White House again. Never, never. You might as well. And you're very old. You are very dynamic and healthy looking. But you already have the injection inside of you, so your time is limited. You know, the mRNA gene therapy injection, and the son of a bitch, he's going to be dead in less than 2 years. And so he doesn't have much time left. So if I were him, I would say, I'll go all out. I'm 70-something. You know, I'm not going to get reelected ever again under this system of fraud, reelected officially, at least. There's no point. So I might as well just do what needs to be done and make the sacrifices that are needed. But he wouldn't do that. So the January 6th people, silence, no one is helping them. But and I kind of feel sorry for them, but on the one hand, but on the other hand, I do feel that they are people who thought of Trump in a way that he shouldn't have been thought of. Trump never deserved that kind of loyalty. Never. Because as we've said on the website where these recordings are posted, we've been saying this since 2015. Trump is a traitor. Trump is a person who will turn his back on you once he's done with you, because he listens to voices that tell him to betray people, and he does it constantly. So he's not trustworthy. I would never give my life in sacrifice for his sake. Never. It's not worth it. It's like throwing, you know, like the old, you know, what it says in the Bible about throwing pearls to the swine or the holy to the dogs. You don't do that. You know, you don't sacrifice yourself for something that's not worth, someone who's not worthy of that sacrifice. So I'd never do that. So they kind of brought it on themselves by being there. And thinking that they would do something for his sake, and also being so naive about thinking that they could, through this sort of Boston Tea Party thing, kind of bring back America to the way it was before. And no, sorry. But even so, despite them having kind of fallen into their own trap, it's as if they were entrapped even before the Democrats entrapped them on that day. They self-entrapped. Even so, I still believe, if I were Trump and knew, okay, these people did this for me, I'm going to also do it for them. I would go and not rest until they were free. And I would make a big deal about it. I would just make a big, big deal about it. But Trump released this video talking about how unfair things have been. But if you listen to it, he just says something like, when I get elected, I'm going to pardon them and all that. But, and that's all he says. So basically, he's still thinking about himself. So he's not trying to fight for their freedom. And he's also being naive, thinking he's going to make it to the White House again. He's not going to make it. First of all, he's going to be dead before he ever could possibly make it. But second, he's not going to, they're not going to let him win. Even if he, you know, does the election thing, they're not going to let him win. The system is already too tainted. And again, as we've said before, neither he nor anybody else has been pointing out what needs to be done to change the system. And because anyone who sits down and thinks about a long-term plan, a visionary plan on how to end this election fraud has to first recognize and look back and realize, hey, the problem starts with the stupidity of the founding fathers allowing election laws to be completely determined by the states. And that's why you have local fraud being so easily instituted. And so it would imply having to deal with that first, and no one wants to do that. So we have to recognize that the founding fathers made mistakes. No one's willing to do that, at least on the conservative side. So no one's offering any solution on how to fix the problem. It's like, oh, no, no, we just have to fight through it and give more, like, cheers and hip hip hoorays and more support and more more campaigns and more stuff, more effort and more emotion to get through this. No, the system is broken. As we said before, it's like those coaches who think that their team can win if they just run harder or are more enthusiastic and more patriotic. You know, especially if they're like a national team. And it's not that. Sometimes it's strategy. The great teams win and play great because they have a style of play that makes them great. A strategy, a style of passing, how they pass the ball around, how they move on the field without the ball. That's what makes them great. That's like, for example, Holland in the 1970s. The football team of Holland became out of nowhere this powerhouse because they developed. There was a guy, I forget his name. Remitz or something. It starts with an R. He developed this system of play called total football, where he kind of dislodged everybody from their fixed position and allowed them to move more dynamically on the field. And suddenly that transformed football. The Dutch football team, the Mechanical Orange of the 1970s, they dominated constantly, you know, against other teams. And why were they that successful? Because they had a new system. They had a different system, an innovative system, and that transformed their team. It wasn't because they needed to run faster to win. They needed to have a new system, and no one recognizes that. So Trump is in this la-la land of delusion, thinking he can win again, and he just needs to, you know, how many rallies has he done? I mean, all the millions of people, and the country's still going to hell. All this effort and all this emotional rallying is doing nothing, because we have to change the system. We have to change the way the whole thing is structured. And to do that, we have to first recognize the current system doesn't work. It's not that there's just bad people out there. No, the bad people are there because of the system. The system enables the bad people. That's why they're there, you stupid conservative idiot. That's why the liberals are there doing the damage they're doing. It's like what's happening with Carrie Lake, the lady who won the election for governor in these recent elections at the time of this recording. But there was a lot of fraud. The machines were not working in Arizona, and she was ahead again. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, the other woman who didn't even want to debate her, was so afraid of her during the campaign. She ended up winning. Sudden massive drop of mail ballots in favor of her, and boom, she went up and she won. So And a lot of people who couldn't vote that day because of all that happened, it was mayhem. I mean, any person with common sense would go, yeah, and there were other irregularities with how the ballots were handled, and some of them were taken to the post office, and then from the post office to the place where they were supposed to go to be counted. And why were they being taken to the post office? Lots of weird things going on. But even if you don't want to admit that there was blatant fraud going on, at least redo the election. You can't certify such an election. Well, Carrie Lake thought that, oh, I'm going to have enough votes to win. When she fell behind, she thought that the ballots that were still being counted would be enough for her. It's like, now I was saying to myself in my heart, well, maybe she knows something I don't know, because I don't live in Arizona. I used to live there for a short while. I don't live there anymore. I don't know what's going on there. So maybe she knows something I don't know. And but suddenly, she thought that she was going to be able to win because of the numbers, the real numbers. But I said to myself, unless I'm missing something, she's not going to win. There's no chance in hell she's going to win with the votes remaining, because the whole thing is rigged. How can you trust them to count on the ballots being counted by some mysterious people somewhere? It didn't make sense, and she lost, and she filed a lawsuit, to fight, you know, the certification of this fraudulent election, and her lawsuit was thrown out recently, and the judge, who was a Obastard appointee, apparently threw it out and also threatened Lake and said, this, you know, you better not do this again. This, I'm sending you a message and to everyone, a message about fraud, about I forget the term, meaningless lawsuits, frivolous lawsuits. And you go, this is not a frivolous lawsuit. A frivolous lawsuit is when someone sues McDonald's for $10 million because they found a hair in their Big Mac. You know, that's a frivolous lawsuit. This is not a frivolous lawsuit. But so now it turns out that to question any election legally is a frivolous lawsuit. That's the message that's being sent out there. And the question is, how can we have a system where this judge can arbitrarily do that, and then I think it's a she, I forget. He or she kills the effort, the legal effort to stop a fraudulent election. Then there is no way to stop a fraudulent election. The system does not allow for it, because it's not clearly laid out. There should be a very clear system, very objective, very quantifiable system, very straightforward, where you can more or less objectively say, hey, this election has a lot of issues, we have to redo it. And then it should be automatic. No one should have to file a lawsuit to have an election overturned or redone. It should be in the system. But no one's talking about how to change the system, how to prevent a system where this judge can arbitrarily stop any effort to decertify a fraudulent election. Because now what can Carrie Lake do? Nothing. The system doesn't work. And again, it's all inside the state of Arizona, because because the stupid founding fathers decided that all elections, even if they have federal repercussions, are controlled by the state. So now everything is inside the state. No one from outside the state, all of us, even the people, all of us who are not living in Arizona, are affected by things going on in Arizona, because they affect federal elections as well. But we cannot do anything about it. Because everything stays inside Arizona, and then all the local people, the politicians, the dirty politicians, cover each other locally. And I all the way from here can't see what's going on behind the scenes, because it's all local. So the thing is that we're living in this world of silence. All these things going on, and no one seems to have the character or the visionary quality necessary to rally and support these people, the few people who are fighting for what's right, not only rally them and speak powerfully in favor of these people fighting for freedom, but also talk about what needs to be done to change the system, to transform the system, and fundamentally reshape it so that we can have freedom permanently. No one is doing that. And that is very sad. And one final note, this is unrelated, but I think it's related in some crazy way, what happened with England playing Wales in the World Cup a few days ago. From the time of this recording, we had spoken in the previous audio snippet how the coach of England had been committing the sin of trying to adapt the players to his system instead of adapting the system to his players. And it's symbolic of how people try to adjust truth to their ideology instead of adjusting their ideology or their way of thinking to the truth, to what is out there. That's what conservatives do all the time. And that's what liberals do all the time. So the thing is that I was surprised that the England coach of the national football team put in the player that we had criticized him for not putting in, a guy called Phil. I think his name is Phil Foden. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I don't follow sport news anymore, but so I don't know how people pronounce it. So I think it's Phil Foden, if I'm getting the name right, a young player from Chelsea, from the Chelsea team, who is a promising talent, but he was being put on the bench because he didn't fit into the coach's system. And he finally put him in, but he put him in a game where he had to lose 4-0 in order to not qualify for the next stage. So it was like he had almost nothing to lose. Like if they didn't play too well, it wouldn't hurt them. So he put in Foden, and he put in another guy named Marcus Rashford. And they both shined. The two of them, these two young guys, were responsible for the three goals that were scored. And they beat Wales 3-0, and they impressed everybody. Oh my goodness, the England team just suddenly came to life because of these two new players. So that took me by surprise. And now they're about to play. The day this recording comes out, by the time you hear it, England will have played, against Senegal. I think they're the African champions or something. I'm not sure. But the thing is that they are playing in the round of 16 or the last 16. They just finished the group stage a few hours from the time of this recording. So they will have played. So I don't know if in this game that's coming in a few hours, whether the coach will put in Foden and Rashford again, or if he's going to play it safe and not put them in now that the game counts, because now this is the knockout stages where if you lose, you're out of the World Cup. So the thing is that we'll see what happens, but I see that maybe as a sign of hope for England, that's kind of a figure of how England might kind of realize, oh, looking back and saying, oh, we made a mistake, and then correcting it. And maybe England will not fall. Who knows? But the thing is, as a nation too, because they're on the verge too, just like America's on the verge. America has less than 10 months to live. And England, I don't know how much time they have, but if America falls, then a whole slew of nations will fall with them, with America. And England might fall in that domino effect. Who knows? I really don't know. Or maybe not. I don't know. The thing is that we'll see what happens. But one thing I wanted to mention about Marcus Rashford, one of those two players that he put in, is that Marcus Rashford is a young black English kid. And from what I've read about him, because I, you know, again, I don't follow sports anymore. Because of all the wokeness and all the nonsense, all the liberal force feeding. I've read that he's a very humble person, very centered, very, very righteous person, and very caring. He's not one of those egotistical athletes who thinks that the world revolves around them and they have money just to spend it on themselves and women and things like that. Apparently, he's not that sort of a person. And to me, he's a sign of what is excellent and hopeful about black people in Britain. As we've said before, the black calling of black America is dead. Black America will not rise up as a people to fulfill its great calling. And as I've said before, I sort of grieve in my heart because I could see it even from a young age. I could see the great potential of Black America, of the great and awesome things that Black America would achieve at all levels. And you could say, oh, they've done a lot in basketball and music, but it would have been more than just good basketball players and good musicians. It would have just been an outbreak, a manifestation. It would have been so incredible to behold, but they threw it all away. So they will never have it. Individuals may kind of be able to tap into that maybe in one way or another, but collectively it will never happen. They will never rise up to the greatness that was set out for them. And they were going to reap the benefits of all that suffering they had gone through, their ancestors, through the slavery and all that. And they collected a short-term reward for that sowing. And they're collecting it, and that's going to be the end of it, and they're done. But I believe that what Black America lost, Black Britain may be able to manifest. And I believe this Marcus Rashford might be part of that. Like a symbol of the greatness of Black Britain, the Black people in Britain, that they may be able to rise and fulfill what Black America failed to fulfill. And as we've said before, Frederick Douglass, one of the 10 greatest Americans of all time, the former slave, when he went in the 19th century, when he went to England and Ireland, when he went to the UK, he felt much better than in his own country here in America, because he was treated with respect. And we've spoken about how England and Britain in general ended slavery much more quickly than we did in America, and a lot of that has been sown into the ground. And hopefully the invasion, the Muslim invasion, is not going to drown that out, because Britain is being invaded culturally in that sense. And I hope that does not drown out the promise for Black America, but the promise is for Black Britain, I'm sorry. And but the promise is there, and I believe it's reflected in that young man. I know that we didn't get to talk about Charles Sumner and Grant, but I believe we will talk about it. I guess we in the next audio snippet we will talk about a little more about the annexation of Santo Domingo, which was the beginning of the rift between Grant and Sumner. And this is all related to Black America, not only because it happened during the Reconstruction period and it created a separation in the Republican Party that eventually led to kind of the end of Reconstruction indirectly, but it also relates in the sense that Grant wanted to annex Santo Domingo as an outlet as a like a valve to allow black people to escape to a place of hope from the South. And in fact, as we're going to mention later, part of the treaty to annex Santo Domingo to the U.S. included eventual statehood. So Santo Domingo, or the Dominican Republic as we know it now, would have become a state. And that would have been kind of, it's kind of weird to me to think of that, that the Dominican Republic would have become another state in the Union. So who knows how that would have gone? I don't believe it would have ended well. So I agree with Sumner there, but sometimes I wonder, did Grant have a vision of something that we could not see? I don't know. And as you know, as you may know, Santo Domingo, or the Dominican Republic, is half of an island, and the other half is occupied by Haiti, which is a black country. A country run by black people. It was the first free black state on earth, you could say, a free black people. For the first time, they had a country, and it was Haiti, and it's right next door to Santo Domingo. So who knows what would have happened if Santo Domingo had become a state. So it's a thing to think about. But it's therefore, you know, all of that shows how it's related to Black America. So we will talk about that. And now the question would be, why are we talking about all of this in the context of Black America, the silence and all these things? I believe it is related in the sense that all this time, I remember when I was a kid, I lived like six blocks from in Baltimore from what you might begin to call ghetto territory. Even though the part where I was kind of okay, if you went six or seven blocks down, the neighborhood changed quite quickly. And Baltimore is a mostly black city. Black people are the majority, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if they were the majority when I lived there when I was a kid. I don't remember. I don't know. But there's always been a significant black population in Baltimore. And Maryland, Baltimore, which is in the state of Maryland, was a slave state. Even though it was part of the Union during the Civil War, it was a slave state, and Baltimore had slavery. But the thing is that when I was a kid, I would think about the people living six or seven blocks down, and I would think, okay, let's fight for those people. Like when I was a kid, I would think about Black America and say, we have to fight for them to enable these kids to live out their potential. I have never really heard anyone talk that way about Black America. Yeah, you could say the Democrats talk like that, but they all do the incite. They all incite Black America to demand reparations. You know, we demand more benefits, more of this. Like just like the stupid idiot in California, the pseudo governor of California who won again, and who knows if he really won the election, special election, recall election that they had recently. But the thing is that he and his idiots in the Democrat government there are proposing a bill to pay reparations to black people in California, $269,000 or something like that dollars per black person. Imagine that. Imagine that as reparations for slavery. And the ironic thing is, California was never a slave state. So why the hell is California paying reparations to black people when California never had slavery? So, but he's proposing that over $200,000 per person, per black person, and as reparations. And that's going to cost over $569 billion. That's more than half $1 trillion. Nonsense. So that doesn't solve the problem. It's giving them more money to do what? To continue this empty life that they have, smoking cannabis all the time, as I have to deal with, in the streets of New York. All of them, and now that smoking cannabis is legal here because of the Democrats promoting it. That's what the money's going to go for, and all the crime and all the destruction, while their public school system is going to hell, and these black people, young kids, don't live with hope of achieving great things. No one is really talking about how to restore black America when it was restorable, not to say a waste of time to talk about that. But the thing is that Black America never had people who spoke on how to, who tried to give black people a sense of vision and hope, and instead of telling them that whitey is oppressing them and that all their woes are because of whitey, if they could have spoken to them about telling them you are the architect of your own destiny, it does not matter what whitey does or does not do to you or for you. You are the one who decides whether you are to succeed or not. And then inspire them to not only, be great musicians or football players or whatever, or basketball players, but to motivate them to become great businessmen, to be business women, to be great scientists, to inspire them. No one has ever done that. No one. And the son of a bitch, old bastard, who he was a self-serving, worthless little bastard who will burn in hell soon. But the little bastard who got 96% of the black vote, and that's when the black people kind of sold their future just to have one half black man in the White House. That's when they sold their destiny. They sold it for to enable him. He could have done so many things to inspire black people as the so-called quote president of the United States. He could have inspired them and told them, you can achieve anything, you can do this, you can live the American dream, and you can prove all the people who have spoken against you wrong and this and that. He could have done so many things to inspire them, but he never did. And on the conservative side, no one does, because the conservative, again, couldn't care less. The conservative is like, oh, just have laissez-faire economics. And I believe in laissez-faire economics, don't get me wrong. But their attitude is, oh, you just let the economy do its thing and black people are going to rise out of poverty. But they don't realize, no, there are a lot of other non-economic factors at play that you have to deal with. Social and spiritual factors you have to deal with. Philosophical, sociological, whatever you want to call it, factors that you have to deal with. You just can't let things work themselves out on their own. Like out of sight, out of mind, I don't care if black people kill each other. As long as they don't get into my neighborhood, it's not my problem. That's how conservatives think. So no one is out there inspiring. The one person who came closest in the Republican Party in my lifetime was Jack Kemp. Most people don't remember him. He was a politician. I think he was, I forget what he was. He might have been a senator or a member of the House. I don't remember. He might have been a senator. He might have been a governor. Or who knows? I think he was a senator. But Jack Kemp, I was a kid when he was around. And he came the closest to kind of reach out to Black America and try to inspire them and enable them. No one has ever talked about restoring the education system for Black America, like really going out and saying it and fighting the teacher unions and doing all these things to enable Black America, to show Black America we care for you, because Black America always had this need of being told we care for you, and no one said that. And some of the last few people who said that to them from the Republican Party were Ulysses S. Grant, sadly enough. And after that, we'll be getting to that later. There was this complete silence, complete silence. And that's part of the silence that ended up killing them at the end. And, you know, at the end of the day, you're the architect of your own destiny. So, yes, there was silence. You could have spoke, you could have restored yourselves despite the silence. But in a way, we are also responsible, in a sense, for not having spoken as a people, as a society, American society, as a nation. And we remain silent. There's oppression going on. All the oppression that was going on in the South in the 50s, in the 40s. And what did the country do? Just keep doing their own thing, minding their own business. And it eventually came to bite us in the rear end. Because all that was festering, all that stuff that was festering in the background led was is a great part of all the disaster destruction that's going on now too. If Black America had been restored properly, they would not be the electoral force that would have enabled a lot of these dirty politicians to be in power now. And we might even they might also be in a visionary role participating in the things we're doing in these audio snippets of calling for the transformation of the American political system, the whole system, society, and rewriting of the Constitution. Black America would have had a great role in doing all these things. And that would have been possible, and we would have been spared from all that has been going on if white people in America or the non-Black people in America would have said, hey, look at what's going on. Let's do something about it. But we kind of let the liberals do the fighting, the few liberals who decided to fight. We let the liberals do the fighting, and then the liberals came and fought for them to a certain extent. Now they don't, but in those days, they did kind of sincerely fight for them. But they also fought and kind of instilled in them a leftist ideology, a Marxist leftist ideology of entitlements, of thinking, I am owed something. You give me something instead of saying, hey, give me the freedom to achieve. But the people who had to speak remained silent. And that's also a contributing factor to all that's been going on now. And now we're complaining, we're making noise about how all the bad stuff is happening to us. But when we had to speak, we could have spoken. And now that we should have not only the urge to speak for ourselves, but to speak for the people of Brazil, the people of China, the people of Iran. No one is doing it. It's like we just say enough. What enough to just get back to where we were before. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just do enough to get it all, you know, just patch up this thing and let's pretend everything is okay again. You know, just like in the Trump years, we said, oh, the economy is great. The conservatives were saying, oh, this is all wonderful. But the debt was running up all increasingly, even though the economy was booming, tax revenues were you know, over the top, and still the national debt kept rising. And it's now at 30-some trillion dollars, and no one cares. There's silence about that. It's like there's something wrong. That national debt is a symbol of all that's wrong. It's like we owe the truth a ton of money. We owe the truth and reality. We owe the truth a ton of money, of figurative and literal money. And we're still silent about it. It's like we only complain when things start affecting us. That's when we say, oh, we should fix this. And then just put a little Band-Aid on it. And then wait for the next, you know, it's like a dam. And we keep plugging up the holes. And the next hole opens up and we go and plug it up. And now the dam is breaking. And now no Band-Aids are good enough for the tidal wave that's coming. And we're still trying to redo this makeshift dam wall to hold things back, and it's not going to happen. We have to redo the whole system. But we remain silent. So I guess that's what this audio snippet was intended to be about. And it is related to Black America, even though we really didn't get to talk too much about the Civil War. But we shall hopefully do so in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.